Many of you here have delighted like we have in listening to Carl Douglas talk. We were fascinated by him in the O.J. Simpson documentary that won ESPN an Oscar. And since he's become sort of lawyer for the show, great talker, obviously. You've heard him recently be very strong on the subject of race. His history with civil rights and law go way back. And so what I wanted to talk to him about a little is sort of his career, because it's an interesting one. He's been a part of the strongest black law firm in the history of this country, one could argue. And so I just wanted to talk to him about that and representing O.J. Simpson and representing Michael Jackson. So we will do that in a moment. But first, I want to tell you that South Beach Session, sponsored by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter, you know, is the smartest way to hire. Thanks to ZipRecruiter for supporting everything here at Lebatard and Friends. Check out Stupidity. Check out Mystery Crate. Rate, subscribe, review. Sarah Spain, Mina Kimes, Marty Smith, all parts of the Lebatard and Friends network. Carl Douglas has become a friend of the show, so let's include him in on Lebatard and Friends and learn a little bit about his career. Carl Douglas, we discovered him, like many of you, in the O.J. Simpson documentary that is one of the finest pieces of television I have ever seen. And he was almost the star of it. You can't really say he's the star, because I guess O.J. Simpson was the star. But his stories were so good and so rich and weirdly honest for a lawyer that I really enjoyed talking to him. And so now I just want to talk to him about other stories, because he's a great storyteller and because he doesn't mind you sort of giving you the truth behind some of what it is that he's experienced. So thank you for being on with us. And I'm just going to get right to the questions. I want to hear about the night that Michael Jackson and O.J. Simpson were both calling you at the same time because they needed legal advice.
Yes, December 27, 1994, the trial of the century was about to start in January. For some, we had taken 2 weeks off for Christmas holidays after picking a jury, and we were going to start with heavy DNA testimony in January. So all the lawyers were hunkering down and getting ready for the trial of the century. For some reason, Robert Shapiro and his family went to Hawaii for those 2 weeks, and he checked into a hotel under an alias like Tony DeMilo or something like that. And there was then behind, no one could understand how he could go on vacation during the most important 2 weeks before the trial.
Well, we would learn a lot after that about just the spawning of Kardashians. They live in a totally different world.
Correct.
This human being, yes, that's extraordinarily bad legal judgment, but this was the guy that OJ trusted, right?
Correct. So there was a decision made, unbeknownst to me, that Johnny was going to become the lead lawyer. You got to understand, Dan, that Bob Shapiro had never really tried a murder case before O.J. Simpson. So he was a general commanding others into the war, but he had never been in a war before himself.
Well, let's just say what it is, right? He's totally overmatched as an attorney. He's the rich guy that O.J. knows, and he knows that do I have it wrong? Am I factually wrong?
You're saying that, not me, Dan. He was the Hollywood fixer. He was Marlon Brando's lawyer and got him on a good deal. But he wasn't known for being a trial lawyer. But Johnny was. So December 27, I got a call from O.J. Simpson. And he told me that he wanted me to become kind of like the coordinator of the team, that he was going to be making a change and that Johnny was going to be the lead lawyer. We all knew, man, it was going to happen sooner or later. But that was the official change. Later that night, we also represented Michael Jackson then. And you got to understand, Michael was really, really paranoid. And whenever Michael would call, he would first use a disguised voice. Hey, hello, is Carl there? And I say, yes, this is Carl. He said, hey, Carl, this is Mike.
He didn't. Oh, wow. I did not know he could do a deep voice. So he was calling in disguise.
He would actually call in disguise. And when you said who you were, he would then change his voice. He would make me go to the very back of my house in the laundry room to the bathroom and close the door and talk with him then. even though my wife was in the far end sleeping and my 5-year-old son was in the bed. But I had to go through my laundry room to my back bathroom and talk with him on the phone. And that same day, he talked with me about his case. So I was only the second person on earth, the first being Johnny Cochran, who had O.J. Simpson and Michael Jackson both talking to them that same night about their case. Bro, I could not sleep that entire night.
Well, I'm wondering, how do you find, what's the backstory on how you find yourself? I mean, this is an uncommon path, right? The idea that somebody in the mid-90s could go through everything America had gone through and become a black attorney talking to Michael Jackson and O.J. Simpson on the same night, that to you, in terms of celebrity, star power, like, what's the path that leads to you ending up there? Because it's improbable. Correct.
What people who are not from Los Angeles don't understand is Johnny Cochran was always as famous in Los Angeles before OJ as he became nationwide after OJ. When Michael Jackson first got in his problems with the first young kid, he called on Johnny Cochran when he was in Mexico, not knowing whether there were charges against him. Because Johnny was just the man. And Johnny called Gil Garcetti. They were personal friends and found out there were no charges pending against Michael. And then Johnny got Elizabeth Taylor's airplane to fly down to Mexico and to bring Michael Jackson back from Mexico. It's funny, Dan, because we had to ask for Michael's permission to represent O.J. Simpson because Michael was our client first. Huh. And Michael was very much give the brother all he needs to help him out. But we first wanted to make sure that Michael was cool with our coming on the O.J. Simpson case.
But what is your backstory? Like, how do you end up? Explain to me, go back to your teenage years and explain to me how you arrive there and how improbable that path is.
Okay, so Johnny Cochran, I'm raised from Los Angeles, lived since I was 2. Johnny was always the man for Black Los Angeles because he represented people who were victimized by police. I came back to L.A. after going to college at Northwestern in Chicago, law school UC Berkeley in Berkeley, and I came back to L.A. and worked at the Federal Public Defender's Office for 5 years, representing people that are charged with federal crimes. Then Los Angeles was the bank robbery capital of the world. Freeways and banks were on every corner. They did not have the plexiglass in the 80s. 80% of the FBI was on bank robbery detail in the mid-80s when I was there. I was there for 5 years. One of my best buddies told me that Johnny Cochran was looking for a lawyer, and I was someone who could come in and try a case. I could try a criminal case, and because Johnny had a criminal background, he knew I could try a civil case. And so I had that combination of a criminal background and a civil background that made it right for Michael Jackson and for O.J. Simpson.
Could you talk to Johnny Cochran in a way a lot of the other attorneys there wouldn't dare talk to Johnny Cochran?
For better or for worse, I was one who always gave truth. Dan, I tell every client today that I have a condition. I suffer from terminal honesty. I will tell them what I think, even if they may not want to hear it, man, because that's just the way I am. I got a story. I remember it was in the post O.J. Simpson. Johnny Cochran was the biggest man on earth, and he was wearing a toupee for the bald spot in the center back of his head. We in the office knew it was a toupee. And it looks stupid. But everyone was afraid to tell Johnny, take that shit off your head. So I gathered with the staff and said, I'm going to tell him. And they said, no, you won't. No, you won't. And I walked into his office. I was the manager, the first among equals of his staff. He was the lone partner, the law office of Johnny L. Cochran Jr. But I was the managing lawyer in the firm. And I sat with him and said, Johnny, take that shit out your hair. It looks stupid. You are young as it is, and you don't need that shit in your hair. Because Dan, when he walked through the office, the incandescent lights shone differently in the toupee, man. And it looked stupid. And I could not have Johnny Cochran, my icon, my hero, be made to look as stupid as it was. And it might have been maybe a week or 2 weeks or maybe a month he kept that in. But because of me, he took it out.
Oh, he eventually
thanked me for that too.
And he did thank you. So how about in that moment? Because that had to be a little bit jarring to hear. Because you reach a certain point in success, Carl, where people absolutely do not tell you the truth. They don't. They'll let you look ridiculous because you've acquired so much success that people get afraid to tell you the real stuff.
Perhaps that's who I am as a person, Dan. But it reflects my love and respect for Johnny Cochran. One thing I could say about Johnny Cochran, I was here for 12 years, man. And Johnny respected you, one, if you could make a payroll, and two, if you could try a case. Every year I was there, I lost at least one case every year. And never once did he criticize me for having lost a case, because he knew you can't hit a home run unless you're up there swinging the bat, man. So it was my love of him that made me tell him that shit was stupid.
Explain to me, though, how he became an icon for you, because I don't know that the audience at large, this was a long time ago, I don't know that the audience at large understands what Johnny Cochran was as a symbol.
That is the value, I think, as a civil rights lawyer from Los Angeles, of that fabulous Oscar award-winning documentary. Because the first 4 hours were nothing about OJ, but it gave you some context of the historical connection between the African-American community and the LAPD here. And no one, Dan, can ever appreciate how the OJ Simpson verdict was possible without understanding that context. And from a young 27-year-old lawyer representing the Settles family, representing Eula Love back in the early 80s, Johnny became a symbol of the fight against all that was wrong in Los Angeles. When you hear about the problems of black and brown people and the police nationwide, man, we were ground zero in Los Angeles for my entire life. So Johnny was always the icon and the bulwark for that which would brought the love of black and brown people in Los Angeles.
Is it fair to say that Johnny Cochran was akin, because of the specific work that he was doing and shining light on, that he was essentially Al Sharpton, that he was Jesse Jackson, that he was part religious leader, part legal leader, part civil rights leader, that he was, I don't mean to turn him into a saint because everybody is a little bit flawed, but you're talking about one of the great black leaders of all time.
And you do a disservice to him by comparing him to Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, I say.
So should I go to Martin Luther King? Should I go, like, honestly, given the work that he was doing, given that he's doing it in the court system, given that he's fighting an unjust systemic problem that not a lot of people outside of Los Angeles knew about who weren't black?
And what's more, he was more than simply a civil rights icon and leader in the black community, because he joined the district attorney's office when John Van de Kamp was the DA. And he was the number three man for 3 years in the district attorney's office. And while there, he created the DA rollout unit, where lawyers, district attorneys were sent on rollout to any and every officer involved shooting. That was in 1981. That was groundbreaking then, and that still goes on today. Now, across the country, whenever there is an officer involved shooting, you're gonna have a district attorney there somewhere close. It's gonna be a whitewash. They're not gonna find anything to charge the cops with a crime, but at least they're going to be there and the cops know that they are there. And so that's something that he started, irrespective of his commitment to the ideals of civil rights and the plight of black and brown people in Los Angeles and the world. I'm a big Johnny Cochran fan, man.
Why do I do a disservice to him by comparing him or putting him in the echelon? Because those were the famous black leaders of the time. Whether or not they did what black folks wanted them doing, whether they were good leaders or not is another matter. But why am I doing a disservice when I compare Johnny Cochran to two of the most famous black leaders in civil rights that there have been?
I know their history perhaps more than you or some of your listeners. And because of their history, I take their gravitas in a greater context. And they are not the iconic black leaders that many may say, because I know their history. I appreciate what they've done and their contribution to the struggle, but their weaknesses to me overshadow my praise for their enlightenment.
So did you see along the path it go to Johnny's head? Did you see? Because there's certain inevitability to success. And I got to think that at some point the ego ran amok there.
Well, he always had a big ego, bruh. Johnny Cochran lived in Los Feliz, which was the exclusive white community in the 70s when nobody black was doing it. Johnny Cochran drove a Rolls Royce in early 70s when nobody had Rolls Royces, okay? I remember after the trial, within a month, we were in Miami at the Miami airport going to meet this kid in jail, federal prison in Miami. And Johnny got off the plane wearing a purple jacket, walking down the center of the aisle in the Miami airport a week after the verdict. I had to stay back. That was before cell phones, man. But he was reveling, just walking down the aisleway. No one who the most dangerous place to be in America is between a trial lawyer and a camera that's working. Let there be no doubt. We all have massive egos, man.
Well, but what about his swag specifically made him different for the time? Because the things that you're talking about there, they could not have been very common. In fact, I can see now where and how it is you'd be attracted to somebody who was that kind of showman.
Johnny Cochran went to Los Angeles High School in the 60s before it was integrated. He was a classmate with Dustin Hoffman. He went to UCLA and was a star on the quarterback on the football team before it was fashionable. So he was always ahead of the curve, man. I'm telling you, for him to be living in Los Feliz in the 70s as a black lawyer was so out of bounds. Black lawyers then lived in Baldwin Hills or Ladera Heights, other portions, the black Beverly Hills. We didn't venture out to the hills of Los Feliz. For him to be driving a Rolls Royce in the early 70s, okay, it was like the parade going through town. And Johnny had this rare ability to connect with kings and paupers alike. He could go to a fancy restaurant and he could go to Tanaka's, a little hole in the wall in Compton, and eat hamburgers and have the juice dripping off of his lips.
When you say that it was inevitable that Johnny Cochran was going to take over the O.J. Simpson case, are you saying because his merits merited it so much more than any of the other lawyers? Are you saying that a percentage of that is because it became obvious very early that this needed to be represented by black people because this was going to become a trial about race? Or are you saying it's a mixture of the two or neither?
It became apparent as we were preparing for trial that Shapiro was behind the curve. We might have had, man, I had 8 or 9 notebooks of reports and interviews and things. And you could tell in the meetings by asking questions where you were in the reading. And we knew Shapiro was not up to speed. There were 9 lawyers working at some point or other on the case. All 9 of us knew who the trial lawyer was. And Johnny had such charisma and such skill that it was clear he was going to be the leader. There was not any dispute of the change when OJ chose to make the change. And it was OJ's choice.
Is it at that moment that the realization dawns on everyone? Oh, this is going to be a trial about race. It's going to be large and symbolic. Or did that happen later? Did the decision on how it is to go about the defense happen later than that?
Dan, as was reflected in the documentary, Shapiro had the thing about Furman and race before Johnny was ever in the case. And that's the irony, man, because the DAs knew about Furman's issues with race before we ever came in the case. And that, for better or for worse, fixed the defense. You could not rightly do a proper defense given that predicate from the 80s where he said, I was so angry at black people that I would beat them up and I wanted to leave the police force. That was manna from heaven. So you could not possibly allow that to go silent. So that formed the defense from the very beginning.
And so how did you end up helping? In what ways did you end up helping Michael Jackson? As you're going into, your back room and he's paranoid, you gotta have some amazing stories about how unusual he is, right?
That's another podcast, man. I was really the first young African-American professional that ever was around Michael Jackson. Most of his advisors were Anglo and they were older. And when he brought Johnny Cochran on, that was unique and unusual for him. And because I had a unique perspective of both criminal and civil, Johnny brought me to handle the lead in his case. And I was Michael Jackson's lawyer off and on for 10 years. Even after I left Johnny's firm, I would still advise Michael Jackson. I was involved. Remember, there was a time when he was in trial in Santa Maria and he got on top of a van after the court and had an umbrella dancing on top of the van. I had a meeting with him after that. I said, Michael, are you crazy? What are you doing dancing on some van? You can't do that stuff. And because we were close, and I was like 5 or 6 years older than Michael, but we were close in age, and I was my honest self. He was always surrounded by sycophants that did not want to slay the goose laying the golden egg.
Oh, but he was such a child, though, wasn't he? He was just a child. Like, did he ever become an adult?
He never had a childhood, and it really was sad. He never had a childhood because from 9 or 10, he was thrust into this regimented lifestyle that his father was able to create so that they could rise to stardom. So I get it. But he missed his childhood in that moment.
Well, he spent it in his adulthood. I never felt like, you say he didn't have a childhood. Okay, so he was made a business professional as a prodigy early on, but he clearly spent the next 30 years. Like, the only way that I can explain to anybody the deviance of the charges that fell upon him is the idea that somewhere mentally he had atrophied where the only thing he could connect with in any way was kids, because he didn't seem to understand adults at all. He seemed to be somebody who was just a child. And it's no defense of him, because some of the things he's been charged with are pretty indefensible, even by your standards as someone who will defend for reasonable doubt. And yet that's what I always assume with him, that the charges are true because he had no earthly understanding of sexually how to be an adult. Like, he just had no connection points with adults.
I understand your perspective. And because he was my client, and some of my views are shaped by personal interviews and comments with him, I'm going to hold off giving my perspective. But a lot of things, man. I was, for example, the lawyer that traveled to Vegas when the first settlement agreement was signed by him. I was the witness. He was at a bungalow in Vegas. And I knocked on the book. Hello, who's there? Again, who's there? He said, Carl. Oh, Carl, come on in. So he opened the door. He comes in. And Michael was a musical genius. He was not the most erudite. He did not have the greatest attention span. He had a security guard for 20 years, Bill Bray. And Bill would tell us, okay, guys, when you're meeting, when Michael starts humming, then you know it's time to stop the meeting. And we would have a meeting, me, Johnny, Howard Weitzman. We would fly to Neverland from the Santa Monica Airport in a helicopter. The coolest thing in the world. Kobe, my heart's with you. But it's a cool thing in the world, flying a helicopter to a meeting. And we'd fly there about 40 minutes to Ojai, meet with Michael in one of his offices at the ranch, and talk about the case. And after about 20, 25 minutes, he would start humming. And you knew it was about, he was losing attention span, and it was time to go then. But he did have a unique life. It was not enjoyable. Be careful what you ask for. He was a prisoner of his success. He was a prisoner.
He was unhappy. Like he was, that had to be clear, right? Because there was no freedom in the way that he was living. It's sort of it's what you're saying. It's the gypsy curse. May you get everything in life that you wish for, because it's a curse.
But Dan, I don't know if he was unhappy, because everything he wanted, he was able to obtain. So I don't know that, you know, from my perspective, it wasn't fun, but I can't say he was unhappy.
So what else do you have? I don't want to save it for another podcast. I want to talk about the ways in which you found him eccentric and unusual.
I went to Trump Towers and met with him at the penthouse in the 90s. Donald's apartment was across the hall, I was told. He had the most fabulous view of Fifth Avenue from the top, fabulous view. He showed me a picture of his children that he had in a book there. And I had a question of whether there was a drop of black blood in the children. And I said, Michael, cut a move. And he would, and cut a move. I said, Michael, play something on the baby grand. And he would just go to the baby grand and he was at once a musical a savant. He was a savant. And you could understand in that moment his genius.
Very few people get access to that, right? Very few people, never mind.
It was just he and I in the apartment. I saw another person there.
And it's a ridiculous apartment. It's the apartment. His whole life was absurd. And like you saw the spending spree that ABC televised of him spending like $3 million in a couple of minutes in Las Vegas.
It was his house in Neverland was the gaudiest, oversized statues, fountain caricatures. There was all kind of shit in there, man. It was ridiculous. All of it, I'm sure, very, very expensive, you know. But, you know, like in the video, I buy that and that and that and that and that and that and just put it all in the house. It was oversized, gold, you know, plated shit. It was,
And so you're, did you go on any of those? Were you around for any of those spending sprees? Because I did want to ask, and this is an indelicate question, but when you say O.J. Simpson had 9 lawyers, it does make me wonder what those billable hours looked like. Like, I don't know if it's been reported what his defense cost, but it had to have been a large fortune.
O.J. Simpson is still alive. And he takes the position that the attorney-client privilege remains until his last breath. And I accept that.
Okay, very good. So I'm asking you not an indelicate question, an illegal one.
but let me tell you this. Your listeners cannot understand how liberating it was that as a defense lawyer, you had virtually the unlimited ability to do anything you needed to do to defend your client. And the lesson of the O.J. Simpson trial, I say, is how underfunded public defender agencies are around the world, so that the defense cannot contest the awesome power of the state. Man, we had some of the best experts I had ever seen in my life. I had been a lawyer 20 years then, and we would have four or five investigators at our beck and call. That was tremendously liberating, but we were able to do that, and we need to do that to contest the power of the DA's office. They had more lawyers. They had more investigators. They had more testing done.
But you had unlimited resources, no? Like it felt like it.
No, to be clear, there was a budget. OJ had a business lawyer. Johnny Cochran's firm was underpaid. Some would say he got a great deal for the money he spent. Certainly, there were collateral benefits of the representation that you balance. Okay.
That's interesting. Actually, that's interesting because you guys knew that handling that case and winning that case is something that sets everybody up for life.
For life. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So of course you can give O.J. Simpson a bit of a discount if that's the reward, because it's a trial of the century. And yeah, you give a little off the top so that you get it on the macro on the back end.
But what you don't know, but we didn't appreciate was I worked on that one trial for 18 months of my life, and I was primarily a civil lawyer. And during those 18 months, we were not bringing in civil cases at the same pace. So our firm suffered dramatically after OJ. I had not tried a criminal case for 10 years before OJ Simpson. Okay. I was a civil lawyer making money.
What kind of arguments would you and Johnny get into regarding these cases that we're talking about? Like how harmonious is all of that, and how contentious is it?
You got to understand, one, I was always one to say my piece, and Johnny always gave me the flexibility to say my piece, and he respected my opinion. Case in point. Reginald Denny, during the riots, the trucker who had a brick thrown on his head, okay? Johnny got a call from Reginald Denny, and Johnny began representing Reginald Denny. I thought he shouldn't, because I didn't want to sue the brothers. I thought that wouldn't look good. And so, okay? God wanted to sue the brothers. And we had a big argument about the wisdom and the merits. The whole firm had the merits. We were an iconic civil rights firm. But what we decided to do, we're not going to sue the brothers. We sued the city of Los Angeles for failing to come to his aid. Mm-hmm. And that was how we were able to use the law beneficially. But there was great internal strife and struggle about whether to accept that case, for example.
How black was the law firm?
I was there 12 years. We had one white lawyer for about a year and a half, a former police officer. And we thought that was unique. We had an interracial staff, support staff. We had Asian secretaries, although we were primarily African-American.
How unusual was that at the time?
In Los Angeles, as a plaintiff firm, I would say in Los Angeles today, there are fewer than 25 black lawyers who make half of their money as a plaintiff, personal injury lawyer, and that's in a city of 9 million. Most African-American lawyers work for the government, or they do defense work because they're criminal lawyers. Because there is greater predictability in that. I have to win in order to keep my doors open. So that helps, that impacts what cases I take, how my pipeline is going. I got to try the case to get them to settle the case. That's why this shutdown hurts me so badly as a plaintiff lawyer, because the one thing you need is a firm trial date to get insurance companies to pay money. In California, there won't be any trials for 9 months, for 3 months after that. The shutdown is lifted. So it really impacts what we can do as lawyers.
What would look like second place in terms of the history of America, a law firm with this kind of black power? A law firm where a black lawyer is empowering black people to defend black people. Does this represent the strongest law firm America's known in this realm? And what does second place look like if it does?
That's an interesting question, and I've never been asked that question. I don't think of myself as a black lawyer who has a black firm. I am a lawyer who happens to be black, who has a firm who represents people that look like me. So I have white clients. I have Asian clients. I relish and welcome the chance to have more white clients because they get paid more money.
Yeah, but Carl, hold on. You guys were a civil rights law firm. I'm trying to figure out what else in America looked like it at the time or since.
In California, in Los Angeles County, there are less than five African-American civil rights plaintiff, less than three African-American based civil rights firm. My firm, the Cochran firm, is still alive in Los Angeles. And there may be one or two smaller firms with two or three lawyers. You got to understand, in Los Angeles, the city is only 5 or 6% black. So it's hard to sustain too much of it. They're not a big market for strictly black law firms. That's just the reality of our numbers. There probably are larger numbers in Washington, D.C., I'm sure. I know there are larger numbers in Atlanta, in New York City, I am sure. In Chicago, I am sure as well. In Detroit, I know because I have buddies that are there.
The reason that I'm asking the question is because I think, and it's odd for me to be trumpeting your horn, I think you're actually being falsely modest here, because I believe that the place that you worked was a civil rights powerhouse fueled by unusual black power, because you had an uncommon identifying point with much of what your clientele was that the white lawyer couldn't possibly understand. And it ended up manifesting itself in the O.J. Simpson trial, where you saw the white lawyer pushed out of the way because O.J. Simpson realized, oh no, I need to get with these black guys. They understand the history of Los Angeles. They're going to be able to actually tell this story in a way that the guy from Brentwood couldn't possibly tell.
Correct. And rarely have I been accused of false modesty.
But it is. It's a pioneering law firm. That's the reason that Johnny Cochran was an icon to you. I'm talking to you right now. I see Jimi Hendrix in the background. You are of a time. You are of a time in a totally different America. You are living in a time where that was the epicenter of some really interesting societal, legal, and civil rights stuff. Because Johnny Cochran in a purple jacket is sitting here saying, this is my constituency. Watch what I can do with a bunch of black lawyers with swag and smarts. Watch what I can do showing the rest of America the injustices in Los Angeles.
And Dan, that's why I like your show and I like doing stuff for you, because you can connect and relate to that even in a sports context, man, unlike few of your contemporaries. That's a good thing for you.
Well, thank you for saying that, but I still don't understand why you're not willing to say, hey, our law firm was a badass pioneering law firm. Why am I the one saying it for you? Why aren't you the one saying it?
We were a badass pioneering law firm because we were not afraid to lose. Okay. And Johnny had such success before I even joined there, man. I just rode the wave, man.
My point is that Michael Jackson and O.J. Simpson didn't end up there by accident.
Sure. Fair enough.
I mean, that's how that ends up happening, because they realize where it is that people understand, even, you know, the criminally misunderstood. Because I don't know whether you saw that HBO, documentary or not, but to me, from my vantage point on the Michael Jackson stuff, I thought that it became obvious in that documentary that he is guilty of pedophilia. Like, am I being an idiot there? Because I thought the documentary was very persuasive.
It's interesting, because when I represented Michael during the first time he was charged, those two guys were exhibits 1 and 2 supporting Michael. Wade Robeson, they were the poster boys supporting that nothing ever went on. And they sounded very believable to me. But it's so ironic, man, because they were the poster boys. You know, we would throw them at their ass every time.
So you watch the documentary, and what do you think to yourself? Because I'm finding they're saying the exact opposite now, and I'm finding them saying the opposite to be persuasive.
I listened to their version. I'm a dish carrier, so I didn't have HBO. I saw it recently in the last 6 months or so. And their story sounded believable to me. Let me say that.
Okay, that's the closest you can get to it, right? As someone who was representing the other side.
Yes.
But at the time, do you have any remorse or guilt about the idea? And this is something that is deeply embedded in the law, though. Like, no, I'm just wondering if at any point there is some crime that comes across your desk where you say, this is something that I can't defend. It's not defensible.
Oh, I have been a lawyer for 40 years. I don't do child molestation cases, ironically. I don't handle rape cases. I don't like them. I don't handle cases of somebody beating up an old lady, particularly an old black lady. I recognize and acknowledge their rights to have firm, strong, competent counsel. I choose not to be that counsel. Okay? So certainly a murder case, no problem to me. Drug case, because the irony is, man, the grocer takes the drug man's money. The realtor takes the drug man's money. You know, the car man takes the drug man's money. Give me a break. Okay.
So when you say, though, that you wouldn't, you don't take child, child abuse cases, the Michael Jackson one is one of the most famous of all time.
Bro, I was an employee in an office. Okay. He said he didn't do it. It's fine with me. Okay. And it was Michael Jackson. Come on.
Well, but no, that what you're saying there seems to, no, go ahead, keep going, because what you're saying.
I'm a trial lawyer. Uh-huh. I want to be on the line with the ball in my hand and the clock running down. Mm. I want to be dribbling the ball. Okay. It is the makeup that 80% of lawyers are not trial lawyers. Okay. There's a certain makeup for those of us that are. I am super hyper competitive. I'm a modern day gunslinger. When I realized I wasn't going to be 6'3", I had to start working the books. You know, so I look at ESPN, CNN, and the Food Network. Because I'm a cook and I like competition.
Man. Okay, there it is.
So the chance to work on Michael Jackson's case, I don't care if it were in filmed and it happened at a church letting out for a bar mitzvah.
So if Michael Jackson had beaten up an old woman and all of the other awful stuff, you might have to, because you're a trial lawyer, first and foremost, you got to go.
I hate to say what I would do. Without question. Without question.
Did you just
have a doubt without question, man? Come on.
Did you just hit yourself in the side of the head? Okay, let's end on that note. Carl, good talking to you. It's always good talking to you. It's always entertaining. Thank you for being on with us. That was funny and it was interesting.
Dan, my pleasure. Please have me on again, please.
Thanks to Carl Douglas for his time and his work. Thank you for listening. Again, we ask you to rate, subscribe, and review Lebatard and Friends, Stupidity, Mystery Crate, Sarah Spain's podcast, That's What She Said, Mina Kimes' show featuring Lenny, and Marty Smith's Carolina / America. Rate, subscribe, and review. We're going to be dark again next week on South Beach Sessions because we've been putting all this stuff out at an alarming rate. We've put too many of them out, so we're dark next week, but we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.